You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 11th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme...
Together, our countries are taking significant steps to strengthen defense security cooperation. We're modernizing command and control structures, and we're increasing the interoperability and planning of our militaries so they can work together in a seamless and effective way.
President Biden hosts the first trilateral White House summit with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and President Marcos Jr. of the Philippines. Ukraine cancels a demobilization plan for long-serving troops. Is manpower and not firepower now the problem for Kyiv? Then...
In the future, we have to find a solution that guarantees security for both us and Russia, of course. But first, make sure that they don't win this war.
We get the latest from the Delphi Economic Forum, plus the business news and our weekly global countdown. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. Well, to Washington, D.C. first, where Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has been on a state visit, culminating today in the first trilateral meeting between the U.S., Japan and the Philippines. Top of the agenda is how to counter China's growing influence and manage the security threat. President Marcos Jr. is also expected to sign a reciprocal access agreement that could see Japanese troops deployed in the Philippines and conducting joint military exercises with the U.S. Well, to discuss the meeting, I'm joined by Washington reporter Simon Mark. Simon, it's great to have you in the studio for the first time.
Great to be here.
State visits usually underscore an administration's strategic priorities. Three of the four previous state dinners, state visits, South Korea, India, Australia, emphasising that Indo-Pacific region focus. Is that top priority for Biden's administration?
Well, I think it's a substantial priority, Vincent. There's no question about that at all. And indeed, administration officials will point to that roster of state visits and state dinners that President Biden has now hosted and say, this really pushes back against the narrative that to some extent the United States has taken its eye off the ball in the Asia-Pacific region. In fact, the Biden administration says that after 4 years of Donald Trump's rule, they have put the focus, the intensity of focus, back on what Barack Obama used to describe as the pivot to Asia. There are clearly two separate audiences for what's taking place in Washington today and yesterday. One audience, of course, is in allied nations and partner nations to the United States, where the Biden administration is seeking to say, look, we are now serious about providing the structure to try and stand up to Chinese expansionism in the region. The second audience, of course, is Beijing. And it is a message that is being sent from Washington to the Chinese capital that these alliances and partnerships are, in the case of Japan, deepening. President Biden yesterday saying that this is the most significant upgrade to the bilateral relationship since the formation of the 1960 Mutual Defense Treaty between the two countries. But it's also, in the case of the Philippines, about shoring things up after the Rodrigo Duterte administration, in which the Philippines became much closer to China than the United States ever wanted to see.
Mm. Just on Japan for now, I mean, during his toast at the state dinner, the prime minister used a quote he favours, he says, from Kennedy, that the Pacific does not separate Japan and the United States, rather it unites us. Now, they were obviously at one point at war across that ocean, but this upgrading, it's basically, you know, the most important relationship for the US in Asia, isn't it, to sort of block China?
I think that's exactly right, without question. And I mean, the details of this expanded relationship include expanding defense architecture with the creation of a joint defense council between the United States and Japan, which will specifically focus on easing the path that Japan's defense exports have of making their way to the United States. The two countries, the U.S. and Japan, will now engage in three-way military exercises with the U.K. Japan will be able to participate in Pillar 2 of AUKUS, that alliance put together by the United States with Australia and the UK. Pillar 2 is going to focus on the development of hypersonic weapons, artificial intelligence and quantum computing. And in a slightly more frivolous way, the United States says they will put a Japanese astronaut on the moon, which is a very big deal. Be the first Japanese pair of feet to set foot on the moon, and the US is going to convey them there.
Come to that. I mean, that's, you know, Britain likes to think it has a special relationship, but that sort of shows that really the relationship between Japan and America is the tightest. I mean, they're going to, you know, the only Americans have landed on the moon. If you're taking a citizen of another country ahead of one of your own citizens, perhaps on a flight to the moon, that is a big sign of friendship, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it is a sign of friendship. It is a sign of advanced diplomacy. And the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, was saying yesterday that this is now a partnership that is built on security, economics, diplomacy, technology and infrastructure. So they're portraying this as a very broad societal partnership. It is worth making the point that in terms of the conversation with the Japanese, as will occur today when the Filipino leader is added to the mix, you know, the spectre of Donald Trump hangs over all of these conversations. And a senior administration official briefing reporters in Washington this week conceded that there is anxiety in world capitals about the extent to which all of these agreements, including the one to put a Japanese astronaut on the moon, may be maintained if Joe Biden loses the election this November.
And they're joined today by President Fernando Marcos Jr. for that trilateral meeting. How important is it for the Biden administration to cement links, not just between itself and countries in the region, but also bridges between the likes of Japan, the Philippines, South Korea and Australia?
Well, the Biden administration sees it as absolutely crucial. They see it as a key hallmark of their efforts to expand American influence in the Asia Pacific, to assist in standing up to what the United States argues is Chinese aggression, particularly in the South China Sea. Some of that aggression has targeted the Filipino naval forces directly, and the United States wants to get involved in beefing up the ability of Manila to push back against that. But the conversation with Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is also rooted in the desire of the United States to bring the Philippines firmly back into its orbit. It has drifted away. It drifted away under Rodrigo Duterte, and it certainly drifted away under Donald Trump, who largely took his eye off the ball in the region. It is very important for the Biden administration to try and show the rest of the world that Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is genuinely seeking a closer relationship with the United States than his predecessor, and a more distant relationship with Beijing than his predecessor was forging.
And do you think the aspiration with all of this is to build a sort of, you know, Pacific Asia version of NATO, perhaps a more formalized structure between these countries?
Yeah, I mean, they won't say that in those terms, but everything that the Biden administration is doing is trying to shore up alliances, strengthen them and develop them and advance them. And that's why, you know, bringing Australia into this mix and the UK into this mix is very, very important for both the State Department and the National Security Council. It is notable, though, that Prime Minister Kishida said yesterday, Ukraine today may be East Asia tomorrow. Now, again, that wasn't in the context of any discussion of a NATO-like alliance, but he was clearly issuing the warning that the reason for strengthening these partnerships is absolutely because of the fears of instability in East Asia, which in very large measure, of course, revolve around China's aspirations, not just towards the South China Sea, but to Taiwan.
Simon Marks, thank you very much. Now here's Monocle's Carlotta Ribello with today's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. Seven people have been killed in a deadly Russian strike that wiped out power for up to 200,000 citizens. It comes as President Vladimir Putin launched a fresh wave of around 40 missiles and 40 drone attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure overnight. The U.S. is sending its top commander in charge of the Middle East to Israel today, ahead of a possible Iranian attack. Iran's supreme leader said Israel must be punished for an airstrike on an Iranian embassy compound in Syria that killed a top Iranian general. And the first foreign-born sumo wrestler to become a grand champion has died, aged 54. Born Shaud Rowan in Hawaii in 1969, Akebono was among the most successful sumo wrestlers of the 1990s. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thank you, Carlotta. Ukrainian lawmakers have sparked anger by scrapping a clause in a draft law that would have allowed soldiers who have spent more than 36 months fighting on the front lines the chance to return home. In perhaps the most telling recent sign of how the war effort is going, a spokesperson for the Ukrainian military said due to the offensive continuing along the entire front line, it's impossible to weaken the defence forces. Well, let's cross over to Kyiv now to get the latest with the Ukrainian journalist Olga Tokariuk. Olga, thank you for joining us. Firstly, how disappointed are Ukrainians about the scrapping of this demobilization plan?
Hello, Vincent, and thanks for having me. Definitely the families of those Ukrainian servicemen who have been serving in the Ukrainian army and defending Ukraine from the full-scale Russian invasion for more than 2 years are the most disappointed, and the servicemen themselves, because they expected they finally will have a chance to get demobilized, to be rotated, to be replaced by some freshmen, and they will have a chance to return to their families and to civilian life in general. So I think that's a big disappointment and frustration specifically for these people, also because many of them joined the Ukrainian armed forces in February 2022 with the thought that the war will not go on for more than several months. You know, there was this expectation at the initial stage that the war will be over soon. And instead, it has been going on for more than 2 years. There is no end in sight. And Ukraine is, frankly, facing difficulties with recruiting more men and women to fight in the army.
Yeah, we hear a lot about the lack of weaponry being an issue, but is personnel now becoming an even greater issue?
Yes, absolutely. You know, and this wasn't actually the idea of the lawmakers to remove the norm on demobilization from the law. It was a requirement and an idea of the new commander-in-chief, Sirsky, who asked the lawmakers to remove this because he said it's not sustainable. It's not possible. There is no one. There are not enough people to replace those who are already in the army. You know, it's a difficult actually balance for the Ukrainian political leadership, for President Zelensky, for the lawmakers who are the coalition, the ruling coalition is from his party, Servant of the People, because they try on the one hand not to alienate the population and kind of respond to this demand that is within the society, you know, to see some rotation, to see servicemen who are there being demobilized and replaced by other people. But on the other hand, they also face the objective reality of the situation on the front line, that Russians are mobilizing an additional 300,000 people. They might be mobilizing even more by the summer. And Ukrainians just do not have resources to match that. And they face increasing pressure on the front line. But actually, you know, the issue of aid, military aid to Ukraine that is being blocked in the US Congress for more than 6 months is a factor here as well, because when Ukraine does not have enough ammunition, does not have enough weaponry to defend itself, it has to pay with the lives of its citizens, with the lives of its servicemen, those in the infantry.
The age of conscription has been lowered to 25. Has that had much effect on getting numbers?
Not yet, because this is something that has just entered into force, but it is expected that dozens of thousands of people will be mobilized as a result. However, Ukrainian experts, military analysts such as Taras Chmut, who is the head of charity Come Back Alive, says it is not enough. He actually said in an interview that was published today by Ukrainska Pravda that Ukraine needs to lower the conscription age to 20 years, because he says otherwise we won't be able to win this war. We won't be able to sustain the war effort. It is very unpopular. It is politically very difficult to a decision, very difficult to make for the president, for the parliament. But it is something that the situation on the front line, unfortunately, dictates.
You know, there is a danger for Ukraine that even if it does win this war eventually, it will have sacrificed an entire generation. Whereas what Russia has done, you know, imbalanced in what it has lost, it has effectively just emptied its prisons. Is that something that Ukrainians think about?
Yes, absolutely. You know, and actually the There is also now, I think in this new law, there is a provision that Ukrainian prisoners, those who are in prisons, will also be mobilized now, will be allowed and will be drafted to the army to replenish the resources. And there are also economic considerations, because the country cannot just survive by fighting. You know, the economy has to survive. There need to be people who are working, who are paying taxes, who are contributing to the economy, who are consuming goods, and many of them are men. It is not feasible, it is not possible to just mobilize the majority of men into the army and hope that the country will survive.
This is The Briefing. Do stay tuned. We turn our attention now to Delphi, where the 9th Annual Economic Forum is currently taking place. Monocle's Andrew Muller and the Foreign Desk team are in attendance, and yesterday they spoke to Stefan Löfven, Club de Madrid member and former Prime Minister of Sweden. While in power, his party, the Swedish Social Democrats, were against joining NATO. Andrew Muller began by asking if he had changed his mind on the matter in 2022.
Yeah, there was a dramatic change. When Putin and Russia attacked Ukraine, that changed everything. So totally new environment, political environment. Look, I stood up for our being non-aligned. I think it was important. I think it has contributed to more of calm in the Northern Europe. You had Sweden, Finland. If you label NATO as a blue force and the Warsaw Pact and then Russia as a red force. But in the northern part of Europe, there was a white field. And I am convinced that contributed to a calmer Europe, to peace and no conflict. And then we were attacked by others in our country, and I would say, we are alone. No, we were not alone. We had cooperation in Nordics. We had bilateral with Finland, very strong bilateral cooperation agreement with Finland. We had a trilateral Finland, USA and Sweden. We had a bilateral with Germany, bilateral with France, bilateral with UK. But when Putin decided to attack Ukraine, everything changed. And we could see quite early that Finland was moving towards a membership in NATO. Now, Finland was the country that we had the strongest cooperation agreement with. And we knew, of course, or the government at the time, but I also could see that if Finland joins NATO, that will, over time, affect the bilateral cooperation. That's just a fact. And when that happens, then, of course, we also needed to apply for membership. So that changed the situation. We tried to tell Putin that, hey, the more worries about being attacked, the more likely it'll be a NATO membership. You said you don't want us to be a member of NATO, okay, but the more Russia causes trouble and anxiety and fear, the more likely it'll be a NATO membership. And look, here we are.
I guess the follow-up question to that is whether you think this is just about Vladimir Putin as an individual, for all that he is obviously a product of his country, or whether this is just always what living next door to Russia is going to be like for everybody who lives next door to Russia, or in Sweden's case, sort of one door along.
Well, we don't know what happens after Putin. Someday he will not be the president, and who comes after, we don't know. It could be better, it could be worse, it could be the same. We just don't know. And that is why it's so very, very important to support Ukraine to make sure that Russia doesn't win this war, because if they do, again, we have no world order. And then again, you have to negotiate with Russia. Even the friendliest, the most democratic president, if someone like that is elected in Russia, Russia will have interests to take care of. So in the future, we have to find a solution that guarantees security for both us and Russia, of course. But first, make sure that they don't win this war.
Just finally, there is obviously one other conflict, which I'm sure is going to be a point of contention at this forum, which is the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Sweden, I think I'm right in saying, was the first EU state to recognise Palestine, which...
We were early anyhow, November 14, I think.
That sounds about right. Do you still have much faith at this point in the idea of a two-state solution?
Yes, a few weeks after the Hamas attack in Israel, I talked to both the Israeli president but also the Palestinian prime minister, Shtayyeh. And I asked him at the time, he now stepped down, as you know, but I asked him, do you believe in the two-state solution still, given all the settlements and all that? And he said, yes, we do. So it is possible. And if you think about it, a one-state solution is even harder. So the two-state solution must be the solution. So yes, I believe in it. It takes the U.S. to be active. It takes the Arab states in the region to be active. But I think there's a leverage right now, given at least that some of the Arab states have started a normalization relation with Israel, which is good, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think now they we can hear, we can see, we can read that they are now also pressuring that a continuing of our discussion with Israel from these Arab states requires that we start a two-state solution process. So it might be that although this war, this terrible war with all these cruelties and deaths and everything, perhaps we can end up in a better situation towards a two-state solution.
You don't think there might be a role as mediator for some former Scandinavian office holder, perhaps?
I don't know. That's totally up to the partners that are involved. They must decide whether they want something, someone, a forum. There could also be something else, not just an individual. It could be something else. I think we have to have a multilateral group working with this. I think that is the most efficient way of going forward. But first and foremost, these two states must decide, yes, we need to start this process. Israel isn't there, obviously. Not this government, we'll see. But I hope there are forces in Israel that will continue, want to continue. The attack October 7th has, of course, made it more difficult. More Israelis are also hostile. More hostile now than there were before, but we can still hear in Israel people wanting a two-state solution.
Stefan Löfven, the former Prime Minister of Sweden there. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Let's check in now with what's making the headlines in the world of business today. I'm joined by Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, good to have you on the programme. A decision on interest rates from the ECB today.
Vincent, yeah, we're going to update on interest rates in the euro area just very shortly. We're expecting them to hold rates at a record high level at 4%. It'll be the fifth meeting which they've held rates. We're expecting rates to start coming down in June. Inflation has been falling nicely. It's now within sight of the ECB's 2% target, but there is a bit of caution over when to start moving lower. Remember that Europe's economies, the 20 countries which share the euro currency, are pretty sluggish. There's not been a lot of GDP growth over the last year. So lots of political leaders would like to get on with interest rate cuts. But the ECB wants to be certain that inflation is under control before they embark on that process. Now, the markets do widely expect that process to start in June. There's been a dialing back in the last few days over how many rate cuts we're going to get over the course of the year. The best estimates from traders now is that there will be 3 quarter point cuts over the course of this year. So starting in June and coming down from current 4% to something like 3.25% by the end of the year. Remember that a bit of monetary loosening has already taken place in Switzerland, the first country to kick off the loosening cycle. But what happens in the euro area will be, of course, very important for investors and perhaps a way to kick off that sluggish growth.
And some new data on Germany's corporate sector. The number of companies in difficulty has been rising.
Yeah, the health of Europe's biggest economy is, of course, of vital interest to officials at the ECB. And new data today on corporate distress levels in Germany. Levels of stress at German companies is now at its highest level in almost 4 years. That puts it ahead of France, Spain, Italy, and indeed the UK when it comes to companies facing difficulties. It's particularly the large manufacturing sector in Germany which is causing problems. It's been wrestling with all those input cost pressures. We spoke to one of the partners at the law firm which carries out this regular survey, and they say that the rise in the European Distress Index this quarter is accounted for by Germany. And that's a story about industrials. It used to be that the UK was one of the outliers in this, but Germany, with its heavy manufacturing sector, has really been feeling the pressure. And it's not just the input costs that have been the problem, but the cutoff of cheap Russian energy supplies. That was a real shock to the German economy. And there's been very weak levels of Asian demand for exports and high interest rates, all feeding into the difficult picture for the German manufacturing sector. When it comes to looking more broadly across the continent at the sectors in distress, it is real estate which is in most trouble. And that is also a German story as well, particularly concerned the commercial real estate sector. This is something which we're seeing right across the world. Of course, office space has been coming down in value post pandemic, not so many people going in, and very high levels of debt in that sector. And that is a particular concern for Germany, as well as many other countries around the continent.
Ewan Potts from Bloomberg, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, it's time for a special edition of The Global Countdown. Today, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaks with Tom Edwards about a selection of spring music highlights that are set to be added to the Monocle Radio playlist. Let's have a listen.
I have a feeling that spring is in the air, not just here in London, but in all sorts of other locations. And perhaps that's a mood, a spirit, a certain flavour that might impact this week's Global Countdown. Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here. What do you say, Fernando? Happy spring? That's not a thing, is it? I don't know.
I think we should start saying happy spring because we had such a severe winter here. I'm not even saying it was that cold, Tom, but it was very grey. We need some sunshine in our
lives. It was
gloomy. It was quite gloomy, I have to say.
Are we talking about tracks that are going to put spring in our step but spread a little sunshine, Fernando? Is that the vibe you're going for?
That's certainly the vibe. So today is kind of a special Global Countdown. I say this every week. Don't worry.
They're always special.
Yes, they're always special. So this one is the Spring Music Part 1. We're back here next week with another selection of 5 tracks. I hope it's a good mix for you. We're going to start with, this is a very optimistic track. In fact, the whole song is about loving yourself. Shall we have a listen? It's the French group L'Impératrice. We all love them. I'm very excited about the new album coming out in June. But that's the first single. And the name, it's in Portuguese, of the song. Me dá igual by L'Impératrice. I wonder if there will be some sort of a Brazilian or Portuguese connection to the new album, because Me Dá Igual is like, give me the same. But if you, of course, the majority of the lyrics are in French. And as I was saying, it's very optimistic. It's a song that, you know, asks you to feel beautiful, basically.
Okay.
Very
beautiful.
I like
it.
Yeah.
Easy synth stylings with a bit of a French accent. That could be a bit of a Olympic hit, couldn't it, later in the summer, maybe? A bit of a moment?
Absolutely. And you know what? I'm very excited, of course, for the Olympics. I wonder which French artist will be there at the opening ceremony, the closing ceremony. I mean, L'Impératrice got a chance. They've been going on since 2012. They are quite popular outside France as well. So, you know, that could be a pick there for the Olympics.
Interesting one to look out for. Let's keep things skipping along. Number four,
a new generation of K-pop. Of course, the genre is now so big that it's hard to say that all K-pop is the same. I don't think that's the case. So, for example, our next track, I didn't know this, but there's some influence of a subgenre called plug, which is some sort of type of trap music.
Trap.
Exactly.
Okay. I wondered where you were going with that one, Fernando.
Let's have
behave yourself. This is a family program, Fernando.
Oh, yes. It's the girl group Illit with Magnetic. Could you feel the plug?
I possibly. Something made me feel somewhat uncomfortable, Fernando, so it could have been that. Maybe this is just how I'm sitting. I don't love that. Can I be honest?
Of course.
I don't like to kind of be a, bring a downer to these upbeat tracks, but that one, that was a bit of a struggle for
me. It's all good. It's all good. I mean, can you imagine if someone just woke up listening to this? I mean,
oh my God. That would be the quintessential waking nightmare as far as I'm concerned.
But let's go back something more kind of Tom friendly, perhaps.
Okay, yes, let's do it.
He's an English producer. His name is Tourist. That's his kind of musician name. The song is Valentine. So this song's quite hypnotic as well. So we're talking here about the Olympics. So in the video for that song, there's this kind of synchronized swimming, you know, doing all their kind of their dances and beautiful movements. So I think this is more kind of, it's electronic. There's a good beat, but maybe less frenetic.
Okay,
as elite.
That's what we need. Should we have a listen?
Let's do it. It's a bit shoegazy in a way. There is kind of, I don't know, something mysterious about this track. I love it very much.
I like that. Good vibes. Now, Faye, are these all on the Monaco Radio playlist then?
Absolutely.
As part of a spring spruce up, if you like.
They're all new additions to the playlist, and I just want to kind of show to our listeners, because sometimes I know a lot of people listen to Monaco Radio on the podcast, but I think they should listen to it live sometimes as well. I think it's a good experience. Plenty of good music.
Exactly.
There.
These are the little gems they might miss.
Exactly.
If they only listen to non-linear formats. What are we up to? Three. Number two. We're getting there. What have you got for me? Nearly at the top of the tree.
We're going back to France here, and this guy, he's fun. I mean, basically, his music's kind of 80s pastiche, but done well. He's a funk musician, but don't worry, there's a lot of synths. He loves to be shirtless and wearing big sunglasses.
Okay.
So, I mean, we're talking spring here, but I think he's very summer.
He's summer ready.
Very, very. I mean, even the name of the track, which we're going to listen to it, he is Dabeul with Body Heat.
Sorry, it's coursing with 80s synth energy.
Yes. I mean, you should look at his face as well. I mean, he's so 80s. I mean,
okay.
It's incredible. And I believe he was performing in London only yesterday.
Okay.
A sold-out gig, I have to say.
Okay, so people are loving the vibe. Maybe it's because he's so relentlessly summery and upbeat and shirtless.
Exactly.
People can't get enough.
We like that. We like that.
That is a good sunny spring track. I wonder what direction you're taking us in with this week's number one pick, Fernando.
Well, number one, I was almost forced to add this song to the playlist. I'm joking, because I like this song very much. But it's the wonderful Beyoncé. I mean, it's inevitable. She's the biggest pop star around, and she just released her country album, which the critics loved it. I mean,
do you make of that, Fernando? Because, you know, there's been lots of different views. Is there a cynicism to it? Is it just smart? Is it a triumph of a sort of branding exercise? What's the Pacheco take?
You know what? I like it. I don't mind a little bit of cynicism. It's pop music. We always had that. And you know what? You know, she did grow up in Texas, and I think she does have a beautiful voice. Of course, no, I didn't like all the tracks in the album. I think some critics gave 5 stars. Maybe I would give 4 stars out of 5.
Okay.
But this song...
That's pretty brutal judgment from the usually upbeat Fernando, I must say.
No, but this song, it's my favorite, I have to say. And there's been a lot of chat here in the office because some people said, Fernando, you should add Yaya or this other track. But I said, I think Bodyguard is such a great tune. It reminds me of the 90s. I don't know why. I want to hear your take as well, Tom. This is the lovely Beyoncé with Bodyguard. You said maybe it's not that country, the track I chose. Maybe I decided that, you know, maybe I didn't want to.
I would like to know whether you've played that to bluegrass aficionado Andrew Miller and asked for his view as something of a country stalwart. Have you had this conversation with him about it?
Yeah, I believe he was talking to our staff Chungo as well, our sound engineer here, because she... She loves Beyonce, of course. But I have a feeling Andrew liked it, right? I wonder.
Did he?
I think Steph is giving us the thumbs up. So,
God, that's wrong-footed me. Yes. I'll have to go and talk to him. Is he all right? He's not had a blow to the head, has
no,
he?
I don't know.
No one dropped a grand piano on him as we're walking around in Leytonstone, did they?
But don't you remind the 90s, this track that we just heard? There's something quite gentle, something, a song that you would listen when you're driving around.
Possibly.
Perhaps Texas.
It possibly wasn't what I was listening to when I was driving around in the 90s. Fernando, in my Mark II Volkswagen Golf. But, you know, interesting. A really interesting selection. And I definitely feel that springtime vibe, which I like. The evenings are brighter. The temperature is eking its way
gradually upwards. I'm almost wearing shorts, so.
Well, you've got a T-shirt and you're wearing some kind of palm frondery T-shirt motif. So I feel like summer's on the way. Fernando, you spread some rays of audio sunshine with that selection. Thanks very much.
And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello. Our researcher was George Ruskin. And our studio manager was Tamsin Howard. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.